Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, we're going to dive a little bit deeper on the concept of assessing fluid responsiveness. Before we go to that, if you've been checking out the blog site, mcrit.org, recently, then you know we had an infusion of 82 posts all in one day, all by the author, Josh Farkas. And as I mentioned in a wee, Josh Farkas of PulmCrit has joined MCRIT. And PulmCrit remains a distinct blog. If you go to PulmCrit.org, you'll find only posts by Josh, but they are integrated into the MCRIT site. You'll see them on the front page every time Josh posts a new, incredibly well-researched blog exploration of something in the area of critical care. And so just be aware, because in the past, if you clicked on anything on MCRIT, it was authored by me. Now, since we have multiple authors, folks like Josh, folks like Mike Loria, hopefully a few new names that you'll be very excited to hear about in the coming weeks, you just have to be careful to look who authored the post so you know who to blame when you get really angry about something being not to your way of thinking. So just be aware of that when you click on a post on MCRIT. Now, it could be from a bunch of different incredibly smart folks. And the reception for the PulmCrit posts have been incredible. If you haven't checked them out, you should come on over. Just go to mcrit.org/PulmCrit or PulmCrit.org and look at all of the previous posts from Josh, and then you will anticipate the ones coming. But let's get to the subject of today's episode. In podcast 64, Paul Marek and I discussed fluid responsiveness. It's an episode that still holds up. If you haven't heard it, you should listen to that one first. And then just recently in podcast 161, we had Jean-Francois Lanteau discussing his four-part assessment of fluids for septic patients. And after that talk, I realized I have to go back and just add some stuff to what's been put on MCRIT. Because my entire paradigm of fluid management has changed over the past decade. I've gone from being pretty loose with the amount of fluids I give to really, after the initial volume resuscitation, really having to convince myself there's any good use of giving additional fluids. And you could see that evolution if you've been tracking MCRIT over the years. But after Jean-Francois' talk, and after just reading a bunch of new stuff that's come out over the past 2 or 3 years, I realized that I've been thinking about fluids in really the wrong way when it comes to assessing whether or not the patient's going to benefit from it. And so I want to make this as simple as possible. And I think we really can make this as simple as possible by asking just two questions, which is, if you're considering this patient may need more volume, the two questions are, can the RV take it? And can the LV use it? Two questions. Can the RV take it? Can the LV use it? Now think about that, because it really puts a lot of the problems we've had with the various modalities to assess fluid responsiveness into a different light. Because you have to ask yourself for each of them, which of these two questions are they answering, or are they answering both? Or in some cases, are they answering neither, in which case you should just throw them into the trash. So the first set of assessments to talk about probably answers both of those questions, because essentially what you're doing is actually giving the additional volume and then seeing the response. So if there is a good response, then it means the RV could have taken it and the LV could use it. And what we're really talking about is either giving a fluid challenge or simulating a fluid challenge with passive leg raising and then actually measuring the response. Let's talk about passive leg raising first. I've mentioned it in previous episodes. I'm not going to go through it all again, but the essence of it is you start off with a patient lying in bed with their head up 45 degrees. You get a baseline measurement, and we'll talk about what those measurements are. And then you lie the patient supine and put their legs up at 45 degrees and then get a second set of measurements sometime in the next 60 to 120 seconds. And if there was an increase in those measurements, then you say the patient probably will respond to volume Because essentially what the passive leg raise is trying to do is to give the simulation of a fluid challenge. Now, why is it a simulation? Because there is this essential translocation of fluid blood from where it was down in the legs and in the lower parts of the abdomen up into the heart, but it's transitory. It disappears. It disappears very quickly, probably in that 120 seconds. The effect is gone. Which, of course, and it's worth mentioning, is why Trendelenburg doesn't work as a position for fluid for patients who are hypotensive, because it is a transitory thing. So passive leg raise simulates a fluid challenge. Alternatively, you could actually give a fluid challenge. You could give 500 mLs of crystalloid or colloid or some variant thereof and see what that does to the measurements. Or, and this is kind of cool, in fact, this is one of the coolest things that's come out in the past few years, is you could give a mini fluid challenge. And what you'll do is you'll give 50 mLs of crystalloid, though I'm sure it could be colloid as well, 50 mLs of crystalloid over 10 seconds. So essentially you want to grab a 50 mL syringe and, you know, for instance, with some plasmolite or Ringers or what have you, or anything, and push those 50 mLs through a central line. Now they say over 10 seconds. But I'm sure it could be less. It's just difficult to get less by, because you have to squeeze in that volume through a central line. This was done in central line. And the article is in the show notes, of course, mcrit.org/162. And then you can measure the cardiac output immediately after those 10 seconds. And the response of cardiac output to those only 50 mLs, which, first of all, it means you don't have to waste 500 mLs on the patient and potentially find out they weren't volume responsive after that, and therefore you just gave them an extra half liter of fluid. And you don't have to wait 10 minutes for those 500 mLs to give in. 10 minutes in the best of all possible circumstances when it's done correctly, meaning those 500 mLs are being pressure bagged in, which they never are. So really, it's a complete waste. You do a fluid challenge, the fluid goes in over a half hour, you have no idea what to do with the values. Forget it. This is great. You could sit there at the bedside. You or your assistant could push the 50 mLs while you're doing the cardiac output measurements. And as soon as that's done, if the cardiac output increases, the patient probably will be responsive to a 500 mL fluid challenge. Super cool, right? All right, but whichever method you use, passive leg raise, real fluid challenge, mini fluid challenge, that's the stress to the system. And then you want to measure the response. Now, I have been in so many critical care units where I've been told, just look at the map. Just look at the patient's blood pressure. And if it goes up, they were obviously fluid responsive. And in some sense, that is true. That is a specific measure of volume responsiveness, right? Because if the pressure went up, then yes, they responded to the volume. I'm not even going to go into now the fact that that's probably transitory, and therefore it's still not a good explanation for why you should give volume, because of course, that's a whole nother show, which we've covered under the very sepsis rubrics. But the point is, yes, if their MAP increases, fine. But the converse, if the MAP decreases, does that predict they wouldn't have responded to volume? No. I have three articles here demonstrating that, because what happens is your afterload shifts as that fluid's being given. So your cardiac index is going up, and therefore you're able to relax some of your vasoconstriction, and therefore there's no change in the MAP at all, even though you've increased your cardiac index, and even though you've made the patient better, ostensibly, and even though they've responded to the volume. So you cannot really use MAP because it lacks sensitivity. What you need to use is some form of cardiac output measurement or cardiac index measurement. Now, on the show I did with Paul, we discussed NICOM, which works with bioreactants. And NICOM looks pretty good, completely non-invasive. It ain't cheap, but it's not as expensive as some of the other monitors. And you could stick one of these in your unit, put on some pasty patches on the patient's chest, and all of a sudden you're measuring something, and I'm not going to go into what, because that's a whole other show as well, and we talked about it with Paul. Magical, that will give you a number for cardiac output, and it'll also give you stroke volume variation, and it'll ostensibly measure the amount of fluid in your lungs, maybe. But it looks pretty good. It's at least looks pretty good for trends. I've had some discrepancies in absolute values changing radically over the course of minutes when we've done nothing to the patient, but it looks pretty good for trends. There was a couple small studies showing it was inaccurate. Those studies seem to have some very conflicted authors in terms of the other products they recommended, but bioreactants, NICOM, may be a good way to go. I don't use any of these anymore, even though I've evaluated all of them. Because I don't care so much about volume responsiveness, which really is the underlying bedrock of this show. And it may come through in my degree of cynicism about all this. And I'm still at the point, as you've heard in the past, you know, year or so, I give an initial volume resuscitation after having done a rush exam and looking at the patient's heart, lungs, IVC. Then I'll give some initial volume. Maybe I'll give a little bit more based on a repeat ultrasound examination of those three things. And then I'll probably stop and put them on pressors. Maybe they'll need some inotropy, which will be epinephrine in my world. But if you want to do volume responsiveness-based treatment, then you know something like a NICOM seems relatively good. Another device I evaluated is the USCOM. USCOM actually looks through Doppler at the aortic arch using a probe that goes in the suprasternal notch, and instead of having to see pictures like you would on an ultrasound, you see waves. And when you get trained on this, and you do need to be trained on this, and it's not an easy learning curve, but once you get it down, and I think I did by the end of my evaluation period, looking at the wave tells you whether you're getting accurate results or not. And if you are getting accurate results, this is extremely good. Like, I'd say it will rival anything if you know how to look at the wave and say this is a real value versus a fake one. And I think it's probably easier than the echocardiographic measurements I'm going to discuss in a second, but it's still not as easy as something like NICOM. But I think it is incredibly accurate. And if you get good at this, all of a sudden you have a very nice cardiac output or cardiac index indicator. Problem? You can't just leave it on the patient. Like once you get that nice window to the patient's aorta, you have to take the device off and then go back and do it again each time. And this is kind of a failing in my mind. That's no fault of the device, but what I want is if I'm going to buy a cardiac output monitor, I want a continuous cardiac output monitor that I could just leave there and I could call up and say to the nurses, hey, what's the patient's cardiac index? Hey, how to change after the fluid? USCOM makes that tough. So do all the echo methods. That's why I don't blame USCOM for this. But it's not exactly what I want. I want something continuous that I don't have to be at the bedside doing something for 2 minutes each time to get a value. So what could you do to get continuous values? You get something like the PICO, which I've evaluated extensively, or the LIDCO, which are essentially, both of these are the same devices. The PICO is pulse contour analysis with intermittent calibration by thermodilution. You inject some cold saline through a central line. It gets measured in an arterial line. You get the same concept of thermodilution you would with a PA catheter. And since you're calibrating that pulse contour analysis, it looks at the waveform and estimates various things to give you a cardiac output. When the patient has any radical changes, like all of a sudden, you know, their afterload has gone to crap, you do a thermodilution and then your PCA is accurate or more accurate than it was without the calibration. LIDCO does the same thing with lithium ion instead of cold fluid, but I only have experience with the PICO. PICO seemed very good. Every time something changed in the patient, we'd do another thermodilution and it seemed pretty accurate. It gives continuous values except for the fact that, again, the accuracy is reliant on the intermittent thermodilutions, and it was nice. We used this at shock trauma. I liked it. What I didn't like so much that they also had at shock trauma were the pulse contour analysis device. I'm not going to tell you which one. I don't want this company suing me, but I thought these were kind of crappy. They do not track changes in afterload or shifts in afterload, so you up on your pressors, you've changed the patient's afterload. They don't trend those well, and there's a bunch of literature to that extent. I don't believe the numbers generated by these sole pulse contour analysis devices. Do you want to buy one of these monitors? I at some point had money to buy one. I decided not to. I put that money into savings for hopefully being able to get a transesophageal echo for my erstwhile unit at Janus General, because I think that's a better use of money. I don't want these devices. They didn't really add anything to my game after I changed the way I handle fluids in the past few years. But the devices are out there. You can measure your passive leg raise or fluid challenge with any of those, with the exception, of course, of the pulse contour analysis alone devices, because I don't believe in them. What about something you have at every critical care unit or most EDs, which should be all EDs, end-tidal CO2? This is interesting. You could measure the response to passive leg raise or fluid challenge with end-tidal CO2. If the end-tidal CO2 has gone up greater than 5% right after a passive leg raise, or perhaps no one's done the validation, but it may work, a mini fluid challenge, or probably a real fluid challenge, so long as nothing else has changed in the patient's respiratory dynamics during the time you were giving the fluid. If you have a greater than 5% and predicted a cardiac index increase of greater than 15%, with not a great sensitivity, only 71%, but a specificity of 100. And this was not a huge trial, but it looks pretty cool. And then there's a second trial done a year later. Both of those are in the show notes. So maybe this is helpful. I don't do any of this, so it doesn't matter to me. But end-tidal CO2 may be the measurement you use to predict the stress working or not. What about some ultrasound stuff? There's been a lot of recent work on both carotid and brachial artery analysis to trend increases in cardiac index as a result of passive leg raising. You could check out all the literature in that. I mean, do a search or go to the ultrasound podcast. That's interesting. I don't do it. Again, it's too much work. You have to go each time you want to decide whether the patient's going to respond. You have to do a passive leg raise, which already is a real hassle. And the people that tell me it's not a hassle, I guarantee you they're not doing it themselves. They're asking someone else to do it. Like they're telling the ICU nurses, could you do a passive leg raise? Because you do this once, you're like, ooh, super cool physiology. And then the thought of doing it every 15 minutes in a septic patient who you're actively resuscitating with fluids during the initial portion of their resuscitation, wow, does this become kludgy to have to go back to the bedside every time you give 500 cc's and do another passive leg raise? Not so much. But carotid, brachial artery, there's something to them. They haven't really been validated enough, probably. What has been, but is really, you know, again, annoying, is the LVOT, velocity time integral, aka the VTI. You find the outflow track, and you actually measure with echo Doppler. You get a wave, you measure it with some calipers, or your machine may do it automatically. And it's super accurate in the hands of experts, not so accurate in the hands of not experts, and again, really annoying. And if you want to be super annoyed, then do a passive leg raise and a velocity time integral, because you have to do it beforehand and after the passive leg raise. Yeah, not happening more than once for me. If your assessment of volume responsiveness is going to be, you do one thing each time you round on the patient for the, you know, big rounds each morning in the ICU, and you want to do these, yeah, it'll demonstrate to the trainees the concept, but come on. Do you really think the trainees are doing this when they're managing 24 patients after those initial rounds? It probably doesn't happen. Or if it is happening, you probably should give those people more patience to watch, because this is a lot of time. And I know people are going to argue with me, oh no, I do this all the time. I do this 15 times in an hour for a patient as I'm, good for you. That's great. I don't think I'm going to use the time for that. Okay, what about looking at the arterial line pressure waveform and getting an assessment of volume responsiveness from that? Something like pulse pressure variation or stroke volume variation. Jean-Francois mentioned it in his talk. Can this be used? And this is where I think those two questions we discussed at the beginning really starts taking a role. Because it seems pulse pressure variation only answers the question of, can the LV use more fluid, but not, can the RV take it? And I have an article demonstrating that in Critical Care Medicine, showing that you will get very misleading, i.e. false positives, if you don't assess the RV in addition to your pulse pressure variation. But what is pulse pressure variation? You have a patient on positive pressure ventilation, meaning they're intubated, and they get a breath. If the pulse pressure, the difference between your systolic and diastolic, decreases as a result of that, it's predictive of the patient being volume responsive. The problem is you need to assess like 10 things to make sure this is accurate before you're going to trust the results. And I have a list of all those 10. It was from an article by Sondergaard. But I mean, it's things like, is the patient in sinus rhythm? Because any dysrhythmia screws it up. Do they have normal chest compliance? Are their valves normal? Is the RV working? Does the patient have elevated intra-abdominal pressure? Is the patient's respiratory rate too high? Is the patient have a reasonable tidal volume, which in most of the studies is 8 mLs per kg? I actually, when I care about pulse pressure variation, I will walk into the room and change the patient's tidal volume to 10 mLs per kg, spend, 10 seconds looking at the waveform to see what's happening, And then I'll put them back to their initial settings, which in sick patients, for me, is 6 mLs per kg. And, you know, trust me, those 20 seconds I'm looking at the waveform is probably not destroying their lungs. It's probably going to be fine. But then I get an accurate pulse pressure variation. I can look up at the waveform and see, did it change when they were getting reasonable Taiyo volumes? If they're on pressure control modes, then they need a 20 centimeter of water driving pressure, the difference between their pressure control and their PEEP, in order to get an accurate assessment. But you could check out the entire list. And when they looked at this in the ICU and in a study in the British Journal of Anesthesia, only an achingly small number of patients met all the criteria. So really, this doesn't have much play. Now, when I have an A-line in, and you folks know if you listen to MCRIT, I love A-lines. If I have an A-line in, of course I'm going to look up and see what's happening between breaths to that arterial waveform, because it just gives me another little bit of information to add to my assessment of the patient. And if I see radical drops with each breath of the pulse pressure, yeah, okay, maybe I'll say this patient could temporarily do something with some volume. They might benefit in the short term from some volume. So I'll look up, but I'm not specifically using this as an assessment. Jean-Francois does. For me, not so much, because, again, my strategy has changed. But I have a lot of evidence and studies on this stuff and how to use it and how to make this more accurate in the show notes, mcrit.org/162. Now, wouldn't it be nice if there was a non-invasive means of doing this for a patient who's already intubated? There probably is. You could probably look at the pulse ox waveform as well and do that same kind of thing with the difference between the top and the bottom between breaths. And there's been a number of studies in the anesthesia literature because they'd love this, because then they have something to use without having to necessarily place an A-line. I put one study in there. There's like, I think 30, 40 studies on this. You could look for them on PubMed, but that may have some value, but it's not as accurate as an arterial waveform. But again, we said, the two questions we care about is, can the RV take it? Can the LV use it? Passive leg raise or volume challenge with measures of cardiac index probably answers both. Pulse pressure variation probably only answers, can the LV use it, but not can the RV take it? And then let's answer that, can the RV take it question. And I was pushing for a little while IV ultrasound as a marker of fluid responsiveness, and I quickly changed my thrust on that to a marker of fluid tolerance, a concept coined by Leichenstein and introduced to me by my friend Chad Myers. And now it makes a lot of sense why the literature on IVC ultrasound doesn't necessarily show it correlates with fluid responsiveness, because it's only answering one of the two questions. And the question it's answering is, can the RV take it? If I'm seeing a lot of respiratory variation with the IVC, that's probably an RV that could accept more fluid. It doesn't mean the LV will use more fluid. This is super cool. It puts it all into context. Now it all makes sense. IVC ultrasound, can the RV take it? So if you're going to do pulse pressure variation, you probably should take a look at your right heart and your IVC to make sure that it could actually take more fluid. CVP, why is it such crap? Because it also probably answers the question, can the RV take it? It doesn't answer it very well because it's static rather than dynamic. There are dynamic measurements of CVP. Those probably are pretty good for the same question. Can the RV take it? They probably don't answer at all. And Paul's multiple meta-analyses demonstrate this of, can the LV use it? So CVP, not a marker of fluid responsiveness. IVC ultrasound, probably not a marker of fluid responsiveness outside of the real extremes. And then it's only because to get to those extremes probably indicates something about the LV as well. But these only answer one of the two questions. All right, this is already going long, so I'm just going to sum it up by one more cool thing that you may or may not have heard of. But there is another test of volume responsiveness called end expiratory occlusion, and this is only for intubated patients. But what you're doing is you're holding down the end expiratory pause, the expiratory pause button on your ventilator. They all have them. And so you're just keeping them from taking in another breath. And if you see either a 5% increase in your pulse pressure or a 5% increase in your cardiac index, then this is predictive of volume responsiveness. And there's been a couple studies on this. It works even in patients with high PEEP. It works even in patients with poor respiratory compliance when pulse pressure variation probably doesn't work. It's super easy, super cool. You go to the vent, you hold the expiratory hold. The patient can't be breaking through with spontaneous breaths through the expiratory hold. They can be a spontaneously breathing patient on the vent, but they can't breathe during the 15 seconds. So you can force that to happen by changing their flow trigger temporarily while you do the expiratory hold. But for either pulse pressure variation or cardiac index changes of greater than 5%, it had a very nice specificity in both. The sensitivity was better with the cardiac index, but not that much better. For both of them, they were around 90. So this is cool. Check this out. I'd like to see more studies on this, but this is a quick and dirty way. And I think if you want to show your fellows something, this is a much cooler and easier thing to show them than the passive leg raise. So just go in, hold down the expiratory hold button on the vent, see what it does to either their pulse pressure or their cardiac index, and boom, predictor of volume responsiveness. I have some other articles on the controversies this is all entailed. Again, to sum it all up, the questions you need to ask after listening to Jean-Francois's lecture and a bunch of other stuff I read is, it's finally come to me, an easy way of saying this, is every time you're deciding, should you give more fluid or not? Can the RV take it? Can the LV use it? These are the questions. There are some things that will answer both. There are some things that will answer only one. For me, doesn't matter so much. Again, to sum up my current strategy, and it may change, it's constantly an evolution, I do a exam of heart, lung, IVC before I start fluids in any patient. I give some initial volume. And again, I don't, you know, some people are telling you you can't even give those initial 2 liters. I think in everyone, unless my initial ultrasound exam told me something very weird, like, you know, their heart is completely overfilled, their IVC has no dynamic variation, and something else is going on, like this patient has profound cardiac dysfunction, I'm going to give them the 2 liters. And then I'll repeat heart, lung, IVC, decide, should I stop there, maybe give a little bit more. And then I'm probably going to put them on vasopressors. And then if I want to give any more fluid, and usually I won't, but if I did, then I'll probably use some marker of volume responsiveness. Hope this all makes sense. If it doesn't, hopefully you'll let me know in the comments, mcrit.org/162. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.